My first visit to PI. It's really nice. Let me thank Luis for the opportunity to present my work. So I'll be talking about curved black holes with scalar hair. And this is work that we've been doing over the last 2 years, although papers only appeared last year. There was a PRL paper, also an essay written for this GRF competition. And there was a longer paper that we put out on January this year with more details and physical properties of the solutions. And this is all work done with Eugene Radu, who's a researcher in our group in Aveiro, Portugal. Okay, so this is the plan of my talk. I would like to give you a bit of a motivation. In this talk, I'll give a bit of a motivation from astrophysics. I'll tell you that there are black hole candidates and that in the near future, we expect to know if these are Kerr-like black holes. So it's timely now to ask the question, could they be different? Are there interesting different models? And while I'll present to you, it's a different model, which at the very worst, I think could be used to generate phenomenologically different templates of some observables from Kerr. And in order for you to understand our model, I'll tell you a bit about boson stars. These are solitonic objects. They've been known for a long time. And then I'll talk about scalar clouds around Kerr black holes, which is related to the superradiance instability. And with these two ingredients, I'll explain to you how these Kerr black holes with scalar hair exist as solutions of the nonlinear Einstein-Klein-Gordon equations. I'll discuss some properties and phenomenology. And then I'll discuss the underlying mechanism for the existence of these solutions, which I've anticipated is related to the superradiant instability. Some extensions, some obvious ones, and pressing questions related to dynamics, particular to stability. Okay, so I'll start with this motivation, and which will be, I think, a bit elementary, but I hope you don't get bothered by hearing things that you probably already know. And my statement is that there is strong observational evidence that extremely compact and massive objects exist. We call them black holes, but really they are only black hole candidates because we don't have evidence of a horizon. Well, one piece of evidence comes from our own galactic center, where there is this radio source called Sagittarius A star. And people over the last couple of decades have been able to trace stars around this galactic center. They go on essentially Keplerian orbits about the common center. And from that, you can extract the mass of that center, which is about 4 million solar masses. This is an animation by ESO, and it projects towards the future. There's also this gas cloud here. Apparently, the evolution of that was different from what was predicted in this video. And that's interesting, but that's another story. By the way, you can interrupt me at any point to ask questions if you'd like, of course. So from the motion of one of these stars, say this S2, it's a well-known star because it has the closest periastron to this Sagittarius A star. One can estimate this mass for 4.1 million solar masses. And then precisely from the pericenter, one can estimate an upper bound on the size, which it's quoted as being about 6 light hours. So that's more or less the orbit of Uranus in our solar system. That's still about 1,500 times larger than the Schwarzschild radius for this mass. There are other constraints coming from the variability of the source, and that put constraints on size of the order of the Schwarzschild radius already, but people are a bit more suspicious about that kind of argument. And there are estimates about the spin, but these are more model dependent and hence also more inaccurate. So this is one type of black hole. We call them supermassive black holes. And it's thought that one exists essentially in the center of each mature galaxy. And they seem to play an important role in structure formation. What you see here is the correlation between the mass of these supermassive black holes for various galaxies. And here in this one, you see the infrared luminosity of the bulge of the host galaxy. Whereas here you see this velocity dispersion of stars in the bulge, and there seems to be some correlation. And this is providing evidence that there is indeed a correlation between the existence of these black holes and how structure forms in these galaxies. A different type of black hole are the stellar mass black holes, just different in terms of their mass. There are various candidates that we know of. The famous one is the Cygnus X1, which is in the Cygnus constellation.
Well, it's thought that, well, the X-ray sources that people see is because there's accretion from a star towards the black hole. So matter accelerates, it emits X-rays. And in this particular case, actually, there is a ninth magnitude star, which apparently we can see with the small telescope. That's nice. From dynamical arguments, you can put an estimate on the mass, which is about 15 solar masses. And again, arguments on the variability of the source, of the X-ray source, put some constraints on the size. So the idea is that if you have some system and if its emission varies, well, its magnitude in an appreciable fashion, it shouldn't vary in a time scale which is smaller than the light crossing time. So it puts an upper bound on the size of the object. So it's a very compact object that people see here as well. Anyway, it could not be a neutron star because people think that neutron stars cannot have masses larger than, say, 3 solar masses. And so it's a black hole candidate. In this case, the measurements of spin claim that it is more fast than the previous one that I've shown you, still far from extremal. And people know in our galaxy about 24 such systems. Here's the representation of 21 in a nice recent review. You can see the black hole candidate, the companion star, its tidal deformation, and also the angle, inclination angle at which you're seeing them. Some of these are permanent, some of these are transient X-ray sources. So will it be possible to demonstrate that really these are black holes in the near future, these black hole candidates? Well, there's various measurements or experiments, observations that will be made. One is related to something that some people here have been developing, which is this Event Horizon Telescope. Uses this VLBI, Very Large Baseline Interferometry technique, and it will try to resolve the shadow of the Sagittarius A star, for instance. And this is the gravitational lensing effect due to this black hole candidate that we have at the center of our galaxy. So what I've put here is the shadow of a Kerr black hole. You can see, well, here the spin axis is orthogonal to the line of sight, and the black hole is rotating such that this edge is sticking out, coming out of the screen, and this one is going in. So what you see is this deformation because co-rotating geodesics can actually approach more the horizon than counter-rotating ones. Now, if you do see a shadow, even if you don't see it very well, it's something because, for instance, some black hole mimickers, that is compact objects that people have suggested, which do not have a horizon, would have, for instance, could have not only different shadows, but no shadow, for instance, boson stars, which is a kind of black hole mimicker, some people like to say, that was suggested. It was shown last year that you can have geodesics that approach arbitrarily close to the center. So you should have no shadow. Okay, and of course, another type of observation that people are eagerly looking forward is gravitational waves. With the developments in numerical relativity, people have essentially solved this two-body problem for black holes, for the canonical black holes of GR, got these waveforms, and with various instruments, especially advanced LIGO, people are expecting to see either black hole binary mergers or neutron stars. And what the community has been doing, as you probably know, is to build some kind of waveform catalogs and that are essential to be used for match filtering. Due to the noise that you will see in these experiments, you need to know what to expect. And it would be nice, again, to have different templates with different models. And we expect different gravitational wave signatures. Well, actually, there are examples. Luis, Leonard, and other people have given an example in scalar tensor theories for neutron stars. I think that's a very interesting example. And it would be nice to have other different examples. So the black holes I'll tell you about, if you could do such kind of evolution, how would it look like? OK, so the GR paradigm to describe these black hole candidates is that they are Kerr black holes. And this is based on uniqueness theorems that were developed in the 1970s, essentially, and that state that the solution found by Kerr is essentially the only solution in vacuum. And Kerr-Newman is the only solution in electrovacuum. Well, if you don't count with something more exotic astrophysically, which is the Majumdar Papapetrum. But anyway, this is something that has been established mathematically, and it gave rise to an idea which has not been established, it's a conjecture, which is called the no-hair idea, that even if you include any kind of matter, essentially the same would hold. Black holes are very special, say unlike stars, because if you have two stars with the same mass and total angular momentum, they can be very different, because the mass can be distributed in a different way and it can have a different quadrupole. But black holes, no. Black holes, if they have the same mass and angular momentum, they are the same. So black holes are special objects. But does this hold when you have any kind of matter? Well, the no-hair idea states that essentially it does, that the collapse, independently of the kind of material that you have around, generates a Kerr-Newman black hole. But we'll expect that the charge astrophysically is not so significant, so essentially a Kerr black hole. And there are no other independent characteristics, and that's what people call hair. It's a metaphor, of course. This is motivated by the uniqueness theorems, but it's a conjecture. And we know it's wrong, at least in its most strict sense. That is, are there no other black hole solutions? Of course there are. And here I'm just focusing on four dimensions and asymptotically flat, because if you vary these things, the story is even much more complicated. Now, other examples have been found in the 90s, and typically they have some nonlinear matter sources, like Young-Mills. This was one of the most famous examples. And the hair is anchored on these nonlinearities of the field. But certainly these tell us the mathematical limitations of this no-hair idea. I should point out that, as it was emphasized by people like Bekenstein in the late 90s, that although all these solutions were found, this violation of the no-hair theorems was not the case for scalar fields. Scalar fields, which were an interesting type of matter, because physicists like scalar fields, they are simple, but they are also well motivated by high energy physics. We know of one that exists. And in string theory compactifications, there are scalar fields and extensions of the standard model. Even in four dimensions, there are scalar fields. And they are a proxy to realistic matter. They can be modeled as a perfect fluid with some equation of state. And in cosmology, of course, people use scalar fields all the time to model both dark energy and dark matter. So I think, well, we all agree that scalar fields are interesting, and there was not examples at this time of black holes with this scalar field hair. Yes, sure.
Were there ones that were stationary and stable against perturbations?
Yes, in the Einstein-Young-Mills, some of these black holes are stationary and stable against perturbations, yes. Okay, so my message is it's then timely to study alternatives to Kerr that can at least parameterize phenomenological deviations. It could be that some alternative is even realistic. And I will suggest one such alternative within general relativity, minimally coupled to a complex massive scalar field. That's it. So there's no fancy self-interactions, and there is no really a kind of complicated energy content. Bayes energy conditions, you can think about it as two real massive scalar fields. Okay, so in order to explain you this, I'll have to introduce two ingredients. The first one is boson stars.
Now, boson stars are self-gravitating solitons, as probably many of you know.
If you just have a scalar field that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation in flat space, if you put some wave back, typically it disperses. Now, if you make it self-gravitate, if you take into account its own gravity, it can actually stay in a bound state. Now, that depends on its self-interactions. You could input some self-interactions. Yeah, but here I'm going to consider only a master. So this is the theory I want to work on. And people have found in the 60s that there are solutions that realize Wheeler's idea of a geon, in a sense. But with a scalar field, Wheeler's idea was with electromagnetic fields and gravity. These are scalar gions. Well, people found spherically symmetric ones initially, and there was some controversy about rotating ones. I'll be describing rotating boson stars because that's what I'm interested in. These were found initially in the late 90s by these people. And the kind of ansatz that you use for your metric and scalar field looks like this. So for your metric, you have a typical stationary axisymmetric line element. It's a viable perpetual form. There are four functions of r and theta, which are spheroidal coordinates. And for your scalar field, you have a profile function, also of r and theta, but you include here an harmonic time dependence, and also these azimuthal dependence, which introduce two constants, m, which is an integer, and the frequency omega, or w. Notice that there are two Killing vector fields, obviously, that preserve the metric, but only a combination of them, which is this helicoidal Killing vector field, preserves this field. So the solution is said to be preserved by a single Killing vector field. And this is going to relate to the black holes with a single Killing vector field that people have been discussed and started discussing in the context of ADS. Also, besides these two parameters that I've told you about, there is n, which is the number of nodes, say, along the equatorial plane of the scalar profile. We'll be considering only nodeless solutions, which are called fundamental state. The other ones are called excited states. Okay? And typically, we'll be focusing on solutions with m equals 1, but I'll show you an example with of other solutions. Now, just to tell you some characteristics about these boson stars, these solutions are found numerically. There are no solutions in closed form, except in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And with some self-interactions. But they've been found by a variety of codes and so on, so there is little doubt that they are there. No, that's for sure. This is a diagram of the ADM mass versus the frequency of the scalar field. Here it's for m, little m equals 1, and everything is in terms of the units of the mass of the scalar field. That's mu, okay? So boson stars, rotating in this case, exist along this red solid line. It starts at 1, that is when the frequency is equal to the mass of the scalar field, and the frequency has to be smaller. That's a bound state condition. Now, as the frequency decreases from this maximal value, you get to the maximal ADM mass. And then the mass decreases, and there's this spiraling behavior. Numerics here become increasingly challenging. It's more difficult. If you look at the phase space diagram, where you plot the ADM mass versus the ADM angular momentum, this is how it looks like. So this is ADM because these solutions are asymptotically flat. There is a concentration of energy. They are regular everywhere. There is no horizon. Okay. And what you see is that there is a positive correlation between the ADM mass and the ADM angular momentum. So for instance, on this branch over here, the ADM mass is increasing, and so is the ADM angular momentum. There's a cusp there. Then they both decreasing, corresponding to this part there. And then there's this third branch corresponding there. And what people have evidence of is that the stability properties of these solutions will change at these cusps. I'll say a bit more about that. Yeah.
Related to that. So these are found numerically in 3D codes or in lower
dimensions? This one is just r and theta dependent. So it's a two-dimensional elliptic problem.
But so, and then how do you know if it is stable against kind of?
Well, from this you don't. No, you have to do something else. So I'll say a bit more about that in just a few slides.
You see those are cusps. Are they real cusps, or is it really smooth and you just can't see
them? Well, there's a maximum of the mass and of the angular momentum. That's all I can say. It seems to be a cusp in this diagram, really. It doesn't seem to be smooth. I don't know. We didn't try to resolve it, to be honest with you. Let me say a few facts about these boson stars. The first one is that there is a conserved Noether charge, and that's because there is a U1 global symmetry. So if you integrate the conserved forecurrent, the time-like component on a space-like surface, you get this conserved Noether charge. Of course, this is just telling us that there is a local continuity. doesn't mean that if you have a scalar field, it cannot vanish. Well, there is a horizon, the scalar field can vanish, can fall into the black hole and vanish from sight. And because the symmetry is not gauged, there would be no signal outside. Okay. Now, for rotating boson stars, there is an interesting quantization condition that people had found early on that says that for a fixed number, particle number, that's really what this is counting, q, then the angular momentum is quantized. That's why actually people were discussing the existence of these rotating boson stars, because they started by doing perturbations of static, that is spherically symmetric ones, and fixing the total number of particles, and they couldn't find it. And it's clear now why, because there's a jump here in the angular momentum. So it's not arbitrarily small when you fix the number of particles. And I'll introduce as a convenient parameter this little q, which is a normalized Noether charge. Notice that for boson stars, this is one, obviously. But it will be useful for parameterizing the space of Kerr black holes with scalar hair that I'll describe. Okay, so this is a plot of surfaces of constant energy, scalar energy density for a typical rotating boson star. And what you see here is that far away, well, sufficiently far away, the surfaces are topologically spherical. But as you get close, they are topologically toroid. Okay, and that's because of the rotation, the angular momentum. The level sets of the scalar field are toroid. Now, about the stability. So in the spherically symmetric case, people have done quite a few things. First of all, you can study radial perturbation stability in that case. And then you can do simulations. People have done simulations. Starting with initial data corresponding to one such star. And then people have used some arguments of something called catastrophe theory as well. Now, they all seem to agree that, and this is then extrapolated to rotating boson stars, where a part of this argument applies. But the perturbative analysis, for instance, is much more complicated, as you can imagine, is that when you get to the critical value of the ADM mass, the properties, stability properties change. And this is analog to actually what you find in fermionic compact stars, like neutron stars, where you label, say, the star by the central density value. And as you increase the central density, you get to a maximum ADM mass, well, mass of the neutron star in that case. And at some point, if you increase more, it actually starts decreasing the total mass. And at that point, it's where the stability property is expected to change. So here, it's at that point that you still expect that there is a stable branch corresponding to this initial set of boson stars. But because these are rotating, there's a different kind of instability, superradiant instabilities. So when you have rotating objects, if they have an ergo region, you'd expect the possibility of some modes to be amplified. And precisely the modes corresponding to the metric perturbation. So they are massive scalar modes. It turns out when you analyze the stability, the existence of ergo regions, you find that there are no ergo region for this branch up to there, to that point. And then there is indeed an ergo torus. Notice it's not an ergo sphere, it's an ergo torus. That appears and that is present on this branch here. So here you would expect superradiant instabilities, and there you don't. Okay? Yes?
Can you connect this solution to the non-rotating one? Doesn't seem that you can ever go to one
way. No, no, there's a minimal rotation, precisely, yes. So boson stars have a minimum rotation.
This ergo torus is inside, far inside that
it star? Is of the order of m, few m, yes, yes. So it's inside, yes. Typically it is.
And on the civil range, you've done the full stability analysis and objective, or are you just saying we don't see any ergo surfaces here, so there's no...
I don't see an ergo surface, an ergo, that's all I can see here.
These guys have like a circular light ring or a
they don't. They don't have a light ring.
Or an innermost stable circular orbit.
No. No. Yes. That's one of that's the reason why you don't expect a shadow precisely.
And do all light rays that begin at infinity end at infinity?
And they can get arbitrarily close to the center. Some of them, yes. This is that paper that I've just referred to by Grand Clément, Gourgouillon, and someone else last year. And they analyzed a particular type of boson stars, I think with phi to the 4 interaction. It's not precisely this one, but I don't see why it should be different. So, of course, you can find solutions with other values of m for this particular model. I've shown you here another two examples with m equals 2 and m equals 3. Here we didn't generate the full spiraling or as much as here in this m equals 1 example. But what you see is that the mass, the maximal value of the mass can increase, and that's the typical behavior, I think. And compactness. So these stars are not really stars because they don't have a surface. The scalar field goes all the way to infinity, but decays exponentially. You can still define a kind of a radius of the star by saying, what is the radius at which, inside which there's 99% of the mass? People use that as a notion of the size of this boson star, okay? And so this is what you can see for this case. So here is the radius in which 99% of the mass is divided by the Schwarzschild radius, and that's what some people have called the inverse compactness, okay? And this radius is, of course, it's not just the radial coordinate, it's so-called circumferential radius. It's such that 2 pi r with this radius is actually the proper length of a circumference on the equatorial plane. And comparing with this curve that I've shown you here, what I would like to illustrate is that the most compact stars are precisely the ones with the largest mass. And it's comparable to black hole compactness, so the black hole would be here. So that's why these are called very compact objects. And actually, some people have used this, the fact that there is a maximal mass on the one hand, and the fact that there is some compactness, to constrain the properties of scalar fields. So the idea, you see, is that since there is a maximal mass here, you can ask, well, can this mass be the mass of a supermassive black hole, say? For this model, this requires the scalar field to be extremely light. In order to have a solar mass, the mass of the scalar field would have to be of the order of 10 to the minus 11 electron volts. And to have a supermassive black hole of, say, 10 to the 9 solar masses, you'd have to have 10 to the minus 19 electron volts. So these are ultralight scalars. They've been proposed, as you probably know, in string theory, in the context of the axiverse. But this kind of requirement can be alleviated by including self-interactions. And in that case, you can get with a much more reasonable mass, reasonable from the viewpoint of ordinary particles, mass of the scalar field, you can get astrophysical masses. Well, in any case, these people used some astrophysical observations. So if you would like to get, say, the mass of the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy, the mass of the scalar field has to be sufficiently small. But if it's very, very small, the compactness of this object will be such that it's too big to fit the constraints that we have. So you can put a window on the mass of the scalar field using these kind of arguments. And that's what these people have done. OK, so this is the first ingredient. I've told you about boson stars. Now, the second ingredient I need to tell you to understand these Kerr black holes with scalar hair is what I've called scalar clouds around Kerr. Now, this is a different calculation. This is a calculation that has been done for 40 years. You consider a test Klein-Gordon field with mass complex on the background of Kerr. It's well known that you can separate variables using spheroidal harmonics, and you get the radial equation. And you can ask, can I find actually bound states, like in quantum mechanics? So in general, on the black hole background, you can only find quasi-bound states, which means that the frequency is not real, it's complex. There's an imaginary part because essentially it's telling you that the scalar field is not really in equilibrium there. It's varying in time because it's being eaten by the black hole. You put a boundary condition, impose a boundary condition, which is that the field is purely ingoing on the horizon in the appropriate frame. And it's exponentially decaying asymptotically. But for Kerr, this is exactly what happens for Schwarzschild, but for Kerr, there's a difference. which is that there is a critical frequency related to the angular velocity of the horizon. And then there are three different regimes. So when the real part of the frequency of the scalar field is larger than the critical frequency, this is the only case that can occur for Schwarzschild, then the imaginary part is negative. And you can see that this means the field is going to be decaying in time. But in the case when the real part is smaller than the critical frequency, then the imaginary part is positive, and there's a growing regime. This is the well-known superradiant regime that was discussed by Preston Tucholsky long ago. But if there is this two, of course, then there is, by continuity, precisely a state for which the imaginary part is zero, and you get these true bound states with a real frequency, and they are what we call clouds. They are states which are in equilibrium with a black hole. Now, it's interesting because these look very much like hydrogen orbitals, in a sense. But when you calculate the basic quantum mechanics problem, what you find is that you can have this Schrodinger cloud in the Coulomb potential as long as there is a quantization of energy. Here you also find a quantization of the background parameters. That is, if you fix the number of nodes, this is the number of nodes of your Klein-Gordon field on the equatorial plane, and these two quantum numbers, or angular momentum numbers, then you can only find a cloud on Kerr on a given existence line, which is a one-parameter subfamily of the full two-dimensional Kerr space. So here, this diagram is for Kerr. This is the mass of the Kerr black hole, and this is the angular velocity of the horizon, everything in terms of the scalar field mass. Extremal Kerr corresponds to this black solid line, and Kerr black holes exist below in this white region. So these blue dotted lines is where the scalar clouds can exist for some quantum numbers. They are all for n equals zero, and they are for m equals l. This is for m equals one equals l, and so on and so forth. Okay, and if you look, say, at the profile of these things, because these are nodeless ones, the ones I've decided to study, there are others, no full ones. So the radial profiles looks like this. So typically, its scalar field starts at a non-zero value on the horizon. It goes to a maximum at some radial distance, and then decays exponentially. So these two correspond to two clouds that appear here on this line. Now, you can study the variation of the scalar clouds with quantum numbers. And in analog models, you can study something similar as well, which we've done this year, but I'm not going to tell you more. So now it becomes more or less clear. You could ask the question from this perspective. Can you make, yes, please. Yeah.
You said that there are clouds, but those clouds are very finely tuned configuration of
Yeah.
Have you studied stability?
Yeah, I'll give you an argument about that. I think they are dynamical attractors, and I'll give you an argument about that. But that's, of course, an important question.
When you say that you, it's a linear analysis, you mean you...
Test field.
Oh, now, what prevents you from doing from linearizing also in the gravitational field and doing, like, in cosmology, usually you do linear analysis?
Yeah, because, because the background doesn't have a scalar field, so at linear level, you don't perturb the background. It's quadratic in the perturbation.
But you could go to second order.
You could go to second order, of course.
As well as to scalar field perturbations.
But the argument is to linear order, it has some reported reaction, which is zero.
Precisely.
So the stability statements you're going to be making are linear stability statements. So.
Not even that, I'm afraid. They are going to be just more heuristic than that, yes. Okay. Yeah? Okay, so these clouds exist at test field level, linear level, as we were discussing. So you can ask the question, can we make them heavy, back react, and still find an exact solution of the Einstein equations, now coupled to the energy momentum tensor of the a complex minimally coupled scalar field, and have a solution. That's what we've done. And for that, we've borrowed the technology from boson stars, and that's why I was describing. So what we've done is to study this kind of ansatz, where you have this new function, n, besides the four functions that I've told you for the metric, and also the fifth function for the scalar field profile. And this new function introduces a new parameter, which is going to be the radius of the horizon. And you try to solve these equations. But then if this is going to yield black holes, then there is a new twist, because these black holes have a single Keeling vector field in the same way that we've discussed for the case of the boson stars. And this is, of course, very much similar to what Diaz, Horowitz, and Santos were doing in ADS. But this is asymptotically flat. It has nothing to do with ADS. But they will be single Keeling vector field black holes in the same way, if you want to use this nomenclature. Now, in order to solve the equations, you have to impose boundary conditions, both asymptotically and near the horizon. Let me just mention that asymptotically, you will have asymptotic flatness. And from the expansion of the metric coefficients, you can get the global quantities. And the scalar field will be exponentially decaying. And you can see immediately from this that the frequency must be smaller than the mass, which, as I've said before, it's a bound state condition. Near the horizon, well, we've introduced this new coordinate, radial coordinate, which starts at the horizon. And you can do, to initiate your integration, some power series expansion of your functions. This function here, which is describing frame dragging, which is the rotation, starts with a constant. And in order to have regularity, you can see immediately from the equations that it has to be the angular, which is the angular velocity of the horizon. You can see immediately from regularity that it must be the frequency over m. And this is precisely the cloud condition I was telling you about. So regularity, in order to have regularity on the horizon, immediately requires the cloud condition. And I'm not going to bother you with the details. It's done numerically. You have to solve. It's five coupled PDEs. We use a relaxation method. And you can indeed find the hairy solutions. Let me just start by giving you this global perspective. So again, here it's the surfaces of constant energy density, which are similar to the boson star case. But now at some constant r, you have the horizon. The horizon is topologically spherical. Geometrically, it's a squashed sphere, just like Kerr. And everything seems to be regular there, the curvature, the scalar field, and so on. So we don't find any pathologies, at least from our data. Now, if you look, say, at metric functions, just to give you an example, nothing very exciting seems to happen. This is a case in which, actually, the solution is very close to Kerr. It's a small scalar field, but the functions are monotonic functions in this coordinate system that we use. And you see the scalar field profile is similar to the clouds that I was telling you about. This is in a compactified coordinate, by the way. The distribution of the scalar field, its energy density, and angular momentum density are exhibited here for an example of one of these Kerr black holes with scalar hair. And you can see that the scalar field, which is this one, is zero on the axis, actually on the horizon. And the same happens to the angular momentum density. By the way, let me say that in the case of boson stars, rotating boson stars, at the origin, scalar field is zero. That's one of the reasons why people don't parameterize boson stars by the value of the scalar field at the origin, which is how typically they do for spherically symmetric boson stars. So you can parameterize the solution by that. There is, yes. I'll precisely tell you this now, yes, which is the same as boson stars. So I'll now give you an overview of the parameter space of the solutions. So here I've put the diagram I've shown you before, which I've used for discussing the scalar clouds. So this is an ADM mass versus angular velocity of the horizon diagram. And I'll superimpose that with the diagram I've shown you for boson stars, which was a frequency versus ADM mass. But you see, the frequency is now the angular velocity. That's the cloud condition up to this m. And I'm considering solutions with m equals 1. So these two diagrams are exactly, they have the same axis. Now, the solutions we found, they sit here. So this is the space of solutions. This is obtained from about 3,000 numerical solutions. So it's a set of points, of course, and we've filled it in. And if you look into it, so here's what you see. The space of solutions where these Kerr black holes with scalar hair exist is delimited by, one, the boson star curve. So showing that the solutions interpolate continuously to boson stars. Two, the Kerr curve. But it's not any Kerr black hole. It's precisely the Kerr black hole that supports the cloud with the appropriate quantum numbers. In this case, it's m equal 1. So if you make the scalar field very small, you get to a Kerr black hole, which can support that cloud. And then there is a third set of points, which is this extremal hairy black hole defined as zero temperature black hole. Now, I've introduced that parameter, you might remember, this little q, which is the normalized Noether charge, which is useful in describing this space. So little q equals 1 are the boson stars, little q equals 0 are Kerr black holes, obviously. And if you draw little q equals constant lines, it seems to be spanning this space in the same way as this boson star curve. We conjecture, although we don't have full evidence, that along this extremal black hole line, which will do something similar as well, the little q will vary from 0 here at the extremal curve until 1 at the end of this curve. And of course, this is our solutions with m equals 1 and n equals 0, but you'll have different, well, other sets of solutions for m equals 1, m equals 2, m equals 3, and other values of n which we did not explore. Typically, the excited states are more unstable than the fundamental state, that is, the n equals 0. OK, so this is the space of solutions, some properties. Well, once you cannot see, it's always a problem. Anyway, so this is the phase space diagram I've shown you before for boson stars. So this is ADM mass, ADM angular momentum, in units of the scalar field mass. Ah, so going to back to your question, so you could see that the maximum mass was that of a boson star. Okay, so for instance, for this model, the maximum mass goes as the Planck mass square over mu. Where mu is the mass of the scalar field.
Oh, basically, because at some point it just forms a black hole?
Well, there are no solutions. So here, you see, this curve allows you a maximal mass. So if you would put, now you're thinking again dynamically, right? So if you'd put a lot of it, probably you'd form a black hole, yes.
And the angular momentum.
So do you want me to go back to the other diagram? Yes.
No, sorry. No, go back to the one that you were just...
Yes.
So there's Q, right? That parameterizes boson star at Q equals
this
1.
This is the Noether charge. So this is the number of particles outside the horizon,
good.
If you want
and
to
J,
think.
Yes, and J
total
is
angular momentum, ADM angular momentum.
Of the system. Okay,
precisely.
Good.
Precise. So here I'm not separating the angular momentum of the black hole and that of the cloud, of the hair.
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
So basically, you have a probably becomes a black hole over that. So
right.
It's not okay.
So let me tell you something more about these the properties of this hairy black hole. So this is the ADM mass versus ADM angular momentum diagram. Now, what you see here is the boson star curve that I've shown you before with the cusps that we were discussing, and the you have this black solid line, which corresponds to extremal Kerr. So in this diagram, you can see Kerr black holes only exist above the black solid line. So because for a given angular momentum, you have to have sufficiently high mass. This is the Kerr limit, the blue dotted line that I've shown you before. And the space where these hairy black holes exist, it's this a bit darker shaded blue region, which I'm not sure you can see very well. It's here, and there is a very subtle line somewhere here, just above the red solid line. I'm sorry, you cannot see it very well, but no.
But why does it have a spike?
The cusps.
Why
this?
Does it have that? Yeah.
So this is because, again, it's a different diagram. So this is ADM mass versus frequency, whereas that is ADM mass versus ADM angular momentum. And it shows that there is a positive correlation between the two. So for instance, the first branch goes like, it's this part here.
Yeah.
And then the ADM mass starts decreasing, and the angular momentum also starts decreasing here, and so on. And that's, as I was explaining before, where you expect stability properties of the solution to change at these critical points of the global quantities. OK. Well, so let me give you some things. First, as you can see, there are solutions which are below the black solid line, so they can violate the Kerr bound.
Why?
Which sense you're saying this curve bound there?
Yeah.
J over m squared can be greater than 1.
Yeah, but stars violate it.
Of course.
All the time.
This violates.
Yeah.
But Kerr doesn't. Kerr doesn't. That's why it's called the curve bound.
Yeah, but there's no black hole.
No, there is. That's my point. So this is where I have the curved black holes with scalar hair.
But the J you're measuring is the J of the space-time.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. I'll come back to that, because you can also violate it in terms of the horizon quantities. This is the global quantity. And you'd say, which is a very good point, I don't care. But I'll show you now in a second. I'll show you in a second. You also violate it in terms of the horizon quantities, which is a bit more surprising, and we can discuss why that happens. So, in terms of the horizon quantities, it violates the curve.
So what happens when the angular momentum goes to zero? These solutions, they go away? Or?
So you cannot get... when the angular momentum goes to zero, the mass has to be going to zero as well. So you'd get a very, very tiny black hole. Where you wouldn't trust this description anyway, so. Yes, please.
Maybe you're gonna show us later. Are you gonna show us the picture, like entropy or area of the horizon?
I will, precisely.
That's gonna be later, okay.
It's gonna be in just a little bit.
Okay.
I'm not gonna anticipate the answer. You'll know in a little bit. Okay, but it's interesting, the answer. Okay, and there's also some non-uniqueness. Because you can see that the solutions exist above the black solid line. You cannot actually see, but I can tell you there's a region here. So there is there are some solutions of hairy black holes and of Kerr black holes with the same ADM mass and the same ADM angular momentum. So in that sense, there is no uniqueness. There's non-uniqueness, but it is raised by the Q, the amount of scalar hair outside the horizon. Now, let's go back to this interesting question, which is what happens in terms of the horizon quantities? Now, we've calculated that, and here it is. This is the horizon angular momentum over the horizon mass square calculated as Komar integrals. And you can see that not only it's violated, but it's by a factor of, well, a few. Like, we could find something until 3. This is for the extremal black holes along that green line. Okay? But there's something interesting. If you try to see how the velocity of the horizon varies, and you have to define, we've defined here a linear velocity of the horizon. By doing the following, multiplying the angular velocity by a radial coordinate, which is the circumferential radius that I've told you about, which has some geometrical meaning. And what you see is that for extremal Kerr, this is the velocity of light. But as you go towards these hairy black holes, which have this material outside, this scalar field, it's smaller. So, although it's violating the curve bound in terms of horizon quantities, the velocity at which the horizon is rotating, if you find this concept of velocity reasonable, it's smaller than the velocity of light. And one interpretation is that the black hole is dragging this heavy environment. And in a sense, it increases its moment of inertia. So it can have more angular momentum, but its angular velocity or linear velocity is smaller. And that's why it seems reasonable that this can occur, at least to me.
So this J is counting the full...
No, this is horizon, so J...
So this is just the component of the black hole...
Precisely. And this is in the frequency diagram, so this is the frequency that I was telling you about, my diagram.
And the red dot is what?
It's Kerr.
So red is the extremal solution.
They are all extremal. Because the hairy black holes have a family of extremals. So because the hairy black holes form a two-dimensional space. So here I've focused on the line, which is the line of extremal solutions, zero temperature. There is one which has no scalar field around. That's Kerr.
That's Kerr. And then
precisely.
So there's a regime where the black hole is not carrying, it's not extremal Kerr by itself.
Precisely.
So there is some angular momentum carried by the cloud, basically.
Yes.
Okay, so this is what you're seeing.
Yes.
But what you said is it's measuring it at the horizon.
I'm measuring at the horizon.
How are you defining
the
horizon?
You're integrating something involving the azimuth killing vector at the horizon.
Yeah.
How do you actually calculate the?
Yeah, exactly.
Horizon?
I think, yeah.
Well, it's a Kolmar integral. Yes. So because you have the horizon, so you have the azimuthal killing vector field. So associated to that, you can define a conserved quantity, which you can compute on the horizon.
But
you can compute it asymptotically as well.
You were saying before that's a killing vector of the metric, but not of the solution.
Precisely. I just used metric for that.
Sorry, you're saying this killing vector is preserved. Numerically, they're not preserved inside matter fields. Are you saying it is it conserved within this or not?
So as you can see by looking at the line element, d by d phi, it's always a killing vector field up to the horizon, so is d by dt. But of course, d by dt is not always timeline because there's an ergo region. But they are killing vectors. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Well, I'll be glad to know more feedback about this because this is a result that surprised me a little bit, but yeah.
This is quite confusing. Anyway, continue.
Okay. So now the question about entropy. So because there is a region of non-uniqueness, what I've compared here, you can argue that you should compare other things, but what we've computed is in this region of non-uniqueness, we've looked at black holes, which have hair and the Kerr black hole with the same total mass and total angular momentum. Here it's ADM. And we've looked at which one has the largest area. Okay? The one that has the largest area is always the hairy black hole. In that sense, they are entropically favored. You wouldn't expect them to decay adiabatically. Of course, this is no proof of stability whatsoever. Very good. And then you could look at some properties of phenomenological interest. We've looked at various already, but let me just say the quadrupole.
By the way,
yes.
If the cloud generates dynamics from the black hole, there's a limit of mass that you can extract.
There is, of course.
Yes, because you're not worried about how these things are generating, I would imagine that limit is actually violated.
Of course, you can have essentially any mass ratio of the total mass to the black hole mass.
Yeah, okay.
It can go to infinity.
No.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Precisely. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not sure, but basically I'm not sure if entropy is a good thing to consider in this case, because in fact, I mean, the process that will lead you, always the process of growth of this cloud leads to black hole entropy increase, but there is a limit to how much you can extract adiabatically, and you are violating. So it's not, I'm not sure if it's the right question to ask. Yes,
in general, yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely right. I agree with you. Yes.
Only
for the ones that could be coming out of the superadiant instability, yes.
You can apply any entropic arguments. But for this, it can be anything.
Sure.
Right? Even if you found something that was less, it wouldn't mean that you had any entropy violation.
That is true, but I found something which is more, which is, in a sense, a bit more reassuring for that process that would be the superadiant growth and instability.
Yeah, but it can be anything, so it's not.
But I agree with you. Okay, so here it's we've looked at this quadrupole moment, the Gerasch-Hansen quadrupole, which has been defined for boson stars. People have looked into that in the context of boson stars as black hole mimickers, namely by Ryan. And there is a well-known procedure to actually extract this, even from a numerical spacetime. Essentially, you do a 1 over r expansion like you would expect, but it has to be in the right gauge, the right coordinate system. And what we found is the following. So as you know, for Kerr, the quadrupole is totally determined by the angular momentum and the mass, and it's in geometrized units minus j square of rem. So here we've computed this reduced quadrupole, which is the quadrupole of our solutions with respect to Kerr. And what you find is that even in the Kerr window, let's call it like that, that's when j of rem square, ADM, is smaller than 1, you can have a considerable deviation that is could be up to one order of magnitude above. Okay, people think that looking at the quadrupole has phenomenological implications. So here's a model where it seems to be different.
We've also looked at the angular frequency at the I-scope. Again, that's important for models of accretion disk, and it can vary by a few percent as well. Yes, it's constant, because you see the line element is constant, yes, precisely. Doesn't vary in time, yeah.
By the way, again, the question is, has anyone looked under what conditions are these for?
These black holes?
These things, yes.
This is an interesting question which we are trying to look at. But first of all, we are trying to assert the stability, which is a related question. The first thing I would do, and that's what we're trying to do, is just put one of these there and perturb it and see how it evolves.
Yeah, but if you don't get it anyway.
Okay.
What does it matter?
That's, I think, the final question. I would like to know. I have limitations, so I go one step at a time.
Do I understand correctly that if you start with a mode that's super radiant and you let its amplitude grow and correspondingly you imagine spinning down the black hole, that this cloud condition just becomes dynamically satisfied at some point?
If you think adiabatically, I'll give you precisely a little animation showing what you're saying. Yes, I think that thinking adiabatically, that's precisely what happens. That's why I called it the dynamical attractor.
I see, and then what if I thought about going from below?
No, it's both. Can I postpone your? Yeah, because I have this animation which I want to show. Anyway, so let me give you about gravitational waves. So we haven't done anything with gravitational waves compared to what I've shown you—a binary of black holes with hair going around and giving you a waveform. But I've done with Juan Carlos de Goyal last year a paper which might bear some relevance. It's a kind of a different signature, but I would like to mention, which is the following. This is a Schwarzschild black hole, and we've put there a scalar wave packet, okay? The scalar wave packet excites one quasi-bound state of Schwarzschild, which is long-lived, okay? So this is a state that will end up decay, but it's there for a long time compared to the ring down that the remaining part of the wave packet triggers. Yes. 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 So a part stays there as a kind of long-lived hair, but not really hair, because it's going to be decaying. Yes.
And also, the other thing you're assuming is a complex scalar. So there's only a
concept chart. Absolutely.
Okay.
And what you see is that the Schwarzschild black hole will ring down, and the ring down is essentially the same as if the black hole wasn't dirty. That is, if this quasi-bound state wasn't lingering there. But as you probably know, in this process, there's this late time tail, which is a power law tail. And unlike the empty case, what you see is that this late time tail has wiggles with the frequency of the quasi-bound state that's around the black hole. So because this late time tail is due to this scattering, so these gravitational waves are trying to get out, but they kind of backscatter a lot. And they probe the space-time. And the space-time, there is this characteristic frequencies of the quasi-bound state, which is there. And so you see it. It's a very tiny effect, but you see it.
Where is the quadrupole coming from?
There is no quadrupole here, sorry.
So where is the gravitational wave?
Scalar radiation.
It's scalar radiation.
No, this is a gravitational wave. So we've perturbed it, really. So we've perturbed the black hole.
So what do you mean perturbed?
So what we've done is we've put a scalar field on the background and calculated the perturbations to linear order in the metric. And so there is gravitational radiation. Okay.
A bulk reaction on the metric from the scalar
field. On the metric, precisely, to linear order.
To linear order.
To linear order, yes.
And why is it in linear order? Because the mu is quadratic in pi.
Yes.
So why is it linear?
It's linear in the curvature.
Zero background value of pi.
I see.
Yes.
I see.
But the t mu nu is it's strictly acts as much as symmetric.
Yeah, but the gravity comes from t mu nu, not.
No, so in this case, it's not spherically symmetric because of the scalar field.
Oh, you don't use one of your.
Yes.
You put in a non-spherically
symmetric scalar field, precisely.
Oh, you perturb phi.
Yes. No, sorry, you perturb the metric by phi. I solve the scalar field equation in the unperturbed background. but I perturb the metric with my scalar field to first order in the curvature.
So the background is Schwarzschild, just to zeroth order.
To zeroth order is Schwarzschild, and I calculate the first order perturbation precisely. Yes.
So it's okay. So at the end, it's second order in the scalar field, which first order in the metric.
Yes, first order in the metric, and I solve the Klein-Gordon equation simultaneously, but in the end, perturb the metric.
So the background isn't the. You're doing Schwarzschild now?
I'm doing Schwarzschild. So this is just a toy model to illustrate how the existence of a long-lived scalar field around the black hole with some frequency could change the gravitational wave signature. That's what I was trying. But it's a much simpler model than the one I was showing you before, because I cannot do it yet. Okay. So, I think I'm... Five more minutes, sorry. So, let me conclude by saying something about mechanism, extensions, and pressing questions. So, mechanism. Now, these hairy black holes interpolate between Kerr and boson stars. They can be seen at linear level. They do not rely on some nonlinear effects, although, of course, the full solution is nonlinear. And from the perspective of Kerr black holes, they are branching towards a new family of solutions due to a classical instability, which is a recurrent thing that you see, say, in higher dimensional black holes. This was a very fashionable topic. You have instabilities of, say, Myers-Perry black holes, and you see branching towards new families. And that's precisely one way to think about what you're seeing here. And there's a mechanism. You see a hairless black hole, which is afflicted by the superradiant instability of a given field. Need not be a scalar field. It could be, say, a massive vector field, for which the energy momentum tensor is time independent. That's important because you can get these clouds for a real scalar field, but instead of being e to the minus I omega t, there will be cosine of omega t. So if you calculate the energy momentum tensor, then you'll have a time dependence. And then you could not really calculate a metric which would be time independent. But if you have a complex scalar field, it's the same as two real scalar fields with opposite phase. So there is this canceling down of the time dependence and also the azimuthal dependence. So if you could have that, then your family of solutions should allow hairy generalizations with that field. Now, obviously, you could do other things. So include self-interactions. We've done this guy, Helgi Runarsson, he's a student of mine. And we are doing, this is 5^4. Actually, there's another group doing that, and which will do it before we. But anyway, so such is life. So here what you see is when you increase the coupling, say you have lambda times 5^4, that's the model here, plus a master. When you increase lambda, the self-interaction, you get this kind of behavior. The maximum mass increases. And in that case, as I've said before, you can get more with more reasonable values for the mass of the scalar field, astrophysical masses for the boson stars and for the hairy black holes. So I'm not going to say much more about this, but I want to say something about the stability. Okay, stability is a difficult problem. You all know that. There's both stability, linear stability, nonlinear stability, all difficult problems. In this case, you see, if you try to calculate perturbations, you don't expect any separation of gravitational and scalar perturbations. It's a difficult problem. This is, by the way, generically Petrov type 1. It doesn't seem, it's not Petrov type D, so it's not algebraically special. So that seems to be a problem. Is that the basis of quasi-normal modes is not a complete basis. So Whiting showed the mode stability of Kerr, but there are claims that, as you know, there is an instability at linear level for extremal Kerr. Now, absolute stability is not mandatory for physical relevance. Well, this is something we could discuss, but anyway. Timescales are what is important compared to other relevant timescales in the system you are studying. Now, in this case, we expect superradiant instabilities, but with longer timescales than in the region of non-uniqueness. So I've put here the distribution of ergo surfaces in the family of solutions. I've told you before that for boson stars, you have a point here where it separates. There is no ergo surface here, and then there is this ergo torus. For the Kerr black holes with scalar hair, there's actually this interesting region here where you get this ergo Saturn. And in the majority of this space, in this diagram, you get just an ergo surface similar to that of Kerr. Now, for instance, you know the timescale for the fastest growing superradiant instability on curve. It goes as something like, if you calculate it in the approximation that Weiler used, that is the mass of the scalar field times the mass of the black hole much smaller than one, which would be something below in this region here, you get something like the time scale is 1 over mu times n to the ninth times the mass over the mass of the sun times 0.12 milliseconds. Well, the two. So for a black hole that has 10 to the 9 solar masses, this will be of the order of million years. So here you have an instability of order of million years. But here on the boson-star line, there is no Virgo region. And so the instability, the time scale is infinity. So you have to go from this finite value to infinity. So it seems that what you'd have in these hairy black holes is a larger time scale than this. This is giving you a lower bound, OK? And why is that? So here's my argument about the stability of the clouds. And it has to do with this mechanism. So now, you can think about this cloud condition, as a synchronization condition of the rotation of the cloud and the angular velocity of the black hole. So here's my little diagram. So this is the black hole. And this is all heuristic. It's a cartoon. And this is the cloud, OK? I've cut it in half so that you can see the rotation, the colors. So the black hole is in black, scalar mode is in red. So when you have this superradiant regime, it means that this angular velocity of the cloud close to the horizon is smaller than the angular velocity of the horizon. So you have something like this. And the superradiance is really that there is a transfer of rotational energy from the black hole to the scalar cloud. And what it wants to do is to synchronize. OK, this is my ability with Keynote. Anyway, so now the opposite regime, I think that's what you were talking about. So this is the decaying regime. It's precisely the opposite, so where the angular velocity of this scalar mode would be larger than that of the horizon. And what you see here is, well, what you expect is the opposite, precisely, that there is a transfer of rotational energy from the scalar cloud to the black hole. So again, this adiabatically seems to be telling you it wants to synchronize. OK, so this is actually very reminiscent of something you know. This is synchronization locking. It's kind of reminiscent of the tidal locking for the Earth-Moon system. And actually, it was proposed by some people that there are some similarities between these tidal interactions and superradiance, I mean, by Vitor Cardoso, Paulo Pani, and some other people. But it suggests that the clouds are dynamical attractors. So why does this bear relevance to what I was telling you? Because now you can imagine the following. You have a hairy black hole. Now, this hairy black hole is perturbed by a scalar mode, which is in the superradiant window. Now, what it wants to do, the superradiant mode wants to grow by kind of slowing down your black hole. But the black hole is anchored on the scalar mode that was already on the background. So as it's kind of starting to slow down, the other one will try to push it or to anchor it. And that's why the time scale seems to be larger. Well, that's my understanding at the moment.
So, but I mean, so it sounds like if you have a spinning black hole and imagine that there's some mass of this particle, you could calculate what is the estimated.
If I would extract, say, all the angular momentum from the black hole, or to get to an equilibrium state.
Angular momentum conservation will exactly give you this. So you have the superradiant one growing, and at some point you have extracted so many particles that the angular momentum goes down. So from the inequality, you go to the equality. And then when the next level grows, actually, let's forget about nonlinearities that we complicated. So the next one level that will grow will have higher angular momentum. So what that level will do as it grows at some point will flip the sign from the equality, will make it inequality, but the opposite that it was before. So the as the m equals 1, m plus 1 mode grows, the m mode decays and gets eaten back to the black hole. Does it make sense? So you start with, let's say the M mod grows, right? It satisfies the superabundance condition, it grows to some level. Angular momentum conservation tells you, I mean, you can call it nonlinear, whatever, but tells you when the size, when what is the maximum size it gets. Now, the next level will grow. Let's say we don't worry about how long it takes. The M plus one will grow. And at some point, that will extract angular, further extract angular momentum, because we can still satisfy the superabundance condition. But for the first level that was grown, it was still sitting around the black hole. Now the sign flips. So it gets eaten back to the black hole. And then the other cloud grows. So it goes
so
like
what is,
that.
What is the end point of all of that?
So at some point, unless you ignore any transitions, in fact, for a sophisticated black hole, I think if you have infinite time, there's nothing around the black hole, and you have a black hole that basically is spinning very little. So the reason is that either you lose the cloud, so you go through the steps till you reach the maximum where you no longer have extracted most of the angular momentum, but the cloud can still decay because also you can have transitions from, even if you have a conserved charge, when from a mode that's M equals non-zero to M equals zero mode, and that gets eaten right away. So you extract the angular momentum, but the mass goes back to the black hole. Does it make sense?
Well, let me add to that as...
Where does the angular momentum end up, you mean?
Do gravitational waves that go away, right? Because the transition is governed with gravitational wave radiation.
But this is only if you have infinite time.
No, of course, that's why I'm talking
because,
about...
Because as you increase M, this quantum number, the time scale
sure.
for the growth of instability becomes
yeah.
larger and larger.
Yeah.
Okay, so the fastest growing mode is the M equals 1. It's L equals 1, actually. And that therefore, you only have M equals 1. So you,
no.
in order... Huh?
You have time for M equals 5.
The time scale to radiate.
Huh?
What is the condition?
No, that's
the
very low. That's very low. I mean, depends on, yes. So you probably,
so
first of physical time scales, you may end up with a cloud at some point that carries some angular momentum around you, and the black hole is slowly spinning. That's what I'm going to be. Unless you have enough time. There is enough time. The L equals 1 grows with 100 seconds. It can grow with 100 seconds.
For supermassive?
For
supermassive, sorry, it's 5 million years.
No, of course, for supermassive, yes. But for stellar mass, you can have situations, and then you can have the other levels growing too.
Okay.
So it's not just the L equals 1.
Yeah, it depends on the black holes.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to conclude, there's a lot of things that I would like to do. They are listed here in not much detail, and I'll just say thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Tomorrow evening or afternoon?
Be glad to have feedback, comments, criticisms. Very glad.
Is there a nice formula for the area of these hairy black holes like there is for a black hole in terms of the parameters M?
I would love it. But everything we've done so far has been numerical.
Okay. Yeah,
one of the things that I would very much interest in doing is to find analytic fits. Various things, including the metric. There are various parameterizations of deviations to occur. I would like to see if you can find some nice fit so that people could use the solutions as well. I'm sure that the community will appreciate that. But at the moment, this is something that we are starting, but I do not have anything yet.
It was a bit counterintuitive when you spun up the black hole even more. You said the area increased. You do it and you spin up the black hole, the area decreased.
Sorry.
The mass. You were comparing hairy black holes to black holes.
But those were with the same mass and
yeah.
angular momentum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Total, ADM. Actually, one of the things that we've changed a little bit the perspective after talking to many people, everything that we've presented in our letter, in our first paper, was in terms of ADM quantities. And now we realize that we should be calculating a lot of things in terms of horizon quantities. That's precisely one of the things that we haven't looked into. Thank you.